Your brain has 200 billion neurons, and each neuron can link to thousands of others, making hundreds of trillions of connections. To perform specific functions, neurons connect to each other to form physical strands called neural networks. But what if there are blockages to certain neural networks? For example, for numbers or for speech, or an inability to understand abstract concepts. The rest of the brain could work perfectly well, yet there can be a profound learning difficulty that prevents success in life. So is that fixed or is it fixable? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello and welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Most of us take for granted the way our brains work. We decide we want to acquire a new skill set, set about learning it, and pretty soon we're doing it. With more practice, it's automatic and requires minimal thought. But what if you're very intelligent and you have a learning difficulty, like a software glitch in your computer? What then? Meet Debbie as she shares about her son, Robert. Watch.
We noticed at 3.5 that Robert had a learning difficulty, and it was things like he was speaking in sentences that were grammatically incorrect, and he had very good models of English, and so I knew with an education background, I was at that point I was a literacy coordinator, so I could tell that that language wasn't right. And so that was one thing. It really alerted us to the fact that he might have difficulties. We just noticed when he was playing, so he would play and he wouldn't answer us, or he wouldn't do what we asked him to do. And I thought at first, maybe he's just what people say, he's being a boy and ignoring the world around him because he was involved in what he was interested in. But as he got older, as I said, 3.5, we were really concerned. We went to a speech pathologist who did a speech assessment with him, and we found that he had a language disorder. So his receptive language, so what he could understand, was in the first percentile. So he was not understanding very much of anything that was going on or being said to him. And his expressive language was in the second percentile. So the world was pretty difficult for him at 3.5. And so that is when we started very early traditional interventions with him. So speech pathology, occupational therapy, and he had excellent therapists. And we held him back from school. We put him into an early intervention preschool, and we held him back from school a year so that he had the best start. Because I was in education, and at that point, by the time he went to school, I was a principal. And I knew a child with a learning difficulty was going to have a hard time at school. And so we put in all that early intervention to try and give him the best start. By the time he was in grade 4, things for him at school became a lot worse. That's when the other students started to notice that he had a learning difficulty. And that's when really things plummeted for him in terms of school.
And plummeted for mum and dad too. Our special guest is a woman who changed her own brain. Sean will be here to help us overcome inertia. We'll find out if apple cider vinegar really is the bee's knees and hear the rest of Robert's incredible story. So let's get started with the news. In the headlines today, graded exercise for chronic fatigue, juice guide for parents, and kids' weight linked to serious adult disease. Guided mild but consistent exercise appears to help chronic fatigue, according to a new UK study. 200 people with chronic fatigue syndrome were randomly assigned to receive specialist medical care alone or with additional exercise support for 3 months. Those in the exercise group received self-help booklet describing a 6-step graded exercise program that would take 12 weeks to complete, with 90 minutes of online or phone guidance from a physiotherapist. After 3 months, those in the exercise group had significantly less fatigue and better physical function, suggesting there's hope for those with chronic fatigue who might try a gently graded exercise program, even a little walking every day. Children under the age of 1 should not be drinking fruit juice, according to a new policy statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics. For toddlers between 1 and 3, half a cup a day may be given, though not at bedtime, not in a sippy cup or a bottle that they carry around. For kids aged 4 to 6, 3/4 of a cup is the maximum per day. And this update is in response to increasing rates of obesity and dental health issues. So parents, if you make water the daily go-to, fresh whole fruit the norm, then juice can be a special treat on special occasions. Overweight boys are at twice the risk for getting colon cancer later in life if they don't shed the pounds before growing up. And overweight kids who become overweight adults have 4 times the risk of depression. Researchers analysed the health records of over 61,000 Danish schoolboys born between 1939 and 1959, and then followed them from age 40 looking for the diagnosis of colon cancer. They found that overweight boys that achieved a normal weight by the time they were young men had no increased risk of colorectal cancer as adults. In a different study, normal weight kids who became overweight in adulthood faced 3 times the risk of depression as adults, and overweight kids who became overweight adults had 4 times the risk. With 1 in 3 US kids being overweight, there's no better time to prevent colorectal cancer and depression by helping our kids lose excess weight. I'm Dr. Narada McKibben, and that's today's health news. Today's guest is Barbara Arrowsmith-Young, author of the book The Woman Who Changed Her Brain and the pioneer of a school program that helps others to do the same. Barbara's story is a riveting read, and here she tells what it was like to start school.
I started school in the late 1950s, and at that point there wasn't even a concept of learning disability or learning difficulty. So in grade 1, I was identified by my teachers having a mental block. And basically, my mother was told that all of my schooling would be an incredible struggle. So I struggled to learn how to read. I struggled to learn how to write. Numbers made no sense. So if you gave me 2 two-digit numbers to add up, I might start at the left and go to the right. And I mean, I would just add the numbers in random sequence. So really struggled with all of early numeracy, literacy. And my mother had been a teacher, so she devised her own strategy of flashcards. So she drilled me every lunch, every day after school, in terms of learning my alphabet, learning my numbers. So eventually I did learn how to read, how to write, to add, do basic numeracy. But the profound deficit that I had was comprehension. So my world was incredibly frightening. I was afraid when somebody would ask me a question because I wouldn't understand. And then if I didn't understand, I wouldn't know how to respond. So even though the outward signs were gone, because I was reading and I was writing and I was doing mathematics, the profound difficulty of comprehending and understanding my world remained all the way through my schooling. Now, I did have some gifts. I had a verbatim auditory memory, so I could listen to a conversation almost like a tape recorder and remember it. But the problem was, if I was having a conversation, I would have to memorize it, walk away, play it over maybe for 2 hours to try to figure out what the person had said. But by that time, there was no possibility to be part of human discourse because obviously that person hadn't waited for 2 hours until I figured it out. I also had a visual photographic memory. So I used that to memorize all of my notebooks, my textbooks. So I go in to write an exam and I would kind of flip through all the pages in my mind and hope that I'd found the right page to match up to the question. And sometimes I did, so I'd get 90%, and sometimes I made a really bad match and I might get 10%. And my teachers didn't understand that because they would assume if I could get 90%, then when I got the 10%, I hadn't studied. Well, I studied as hard to get that 10% as the 90%. And then another strength I had was what we call now executive functioning, the prefrontal cortex, so that thinking, drive, problem solving. So I kind of joke that in grade one I became a workaholic and I became driven to find a solution for my difficulties. And so that was my beginning. And also I was very blessed that I had a mother who had won an award in the province of Ontario in Canada for her contribution to education. And I had a father who was an inventor and a scientist. And his belief that he instilled in me very early was, if there's a problem and there's no solution in the world, he said, it's your responsibility for humanity to go out and find a solution. So I feel like I was set on a quest at an early age to find a solution for my difficulties, and that's what I did.
She certainly took that responsibility to find a solution very seriously. Now, on a lighter note.
There.
Oh, looky there. This would be perfect. This will keep me safe riding my bicycle.
Looks great, but it's really not a safety helmet.
Oh, you don't think so? I'm not worried about wearing a helmet. We never had them when we were kids, and I turned out just fine.
I'm not so sure about that.
What do you mean?
Oh, never mind. Our grandparents didn't have bike helmets. They also didn't have running toilets. So by the same logic, are you saying that you don't need a toilet either?
Oh no, I definitely need a toilet, but helmets are for sissies.
But in a crash, they reduce the risk of head injuries by 50%.
But that won't happen to me.
And they reduce the risk of face and neck injuries by over 30%.
Oh well, I guess with this beautiful face, I better wear a helmet, huh?
83% of people who die in a bike crash, we're not wearing a helmet.
You know what? You have convinced me I need to wear a helmet, but I wish I could find one that was as cool as this watermelon.
Well, how about this one?
Oh, wow. Thanks for that. Cool. Thanks.
Wear a helmet and protect your melon. Doctor's orders.
Apple cider vinegar is all the rage. It's touted to brighten skin, remove warts, banish belly fat, lower blood sugar, fight cancer, soothe a sore throat, avert heartburn, amongst other things. But are any of these claims true? Well, let's start by finding out how vinegar is made. First, sugar from a fruit or cereal is fermented by yeast to produce alcohol. So in the case of apple cider vinegar, it's going to be apples. Next, that alcohol is combined with acetic acid bacteria to ferment it and make acetic acid. So here we have the alcohol, and it's a fairly simple process. We remove those two in the fermentation process and add another oxygen. And here we have acetic acid. If it will, there, acetic acid. Most vinegars are then filtered and pasteurized, but some vinegar manufacturers just leave the bacteria there. They call it the mother. And then they label that product unfiltered or raw. And this is commonly what happens with apple cider vinegar. So you'll see unfiltered apple cider vinegar. That means that that mother is still there. There could be some redeeming qualities to the mother if it's a probiotic, but really vinegar is vinegar no matter what the yeast originally fermented. Now, in vinegar, there are a number of volatile compounds, alcohols, acids, esters, aldehydes, and ketones, or rather chemical names, aren't they? But actually, the taste will vary depending on what originally was used to ferment, whether it was apples or cereal. Though it's the acetic acid, this little molecule, that all the claims relate to. So does this acetic acid affect warts? Well, we actually use it as a kind of a diagnostically to turn them white so we can see them, but it doesn't make them go away. So don't waste time treating your warts with vinegar. Use something that really works. With regard to fighting cancer, there's not good evidence available. One study in China suggested less esophageal cancer. One study in Serbia suggested a much higher risk of bladder cancer. So how about losing weight? Only one study available, small amount of weight loss done by the industry, so again, we don't know. Heartburn? Well, some people claim that heartburn is due to a too little stomach acid. The stomach then overworks to make more acid, which then goes up the esophagus. In actual fact, heartburn occurs when the muscular sphincter between the esophagus and the stomach is too weak for the loads that are put on it, and so the acid goes up the esophagus and burns it. If we add vinegar, that will make it worse because it slows stomach emptying. And besides, infusing acid, including vinegar, any kind of acid, into the esophagus will mimic heartburn symptoms. In research, they will create ulcers in stomachs and esophaguses of animals and then look to see what they can use to heal it. And those ulcers are formed by putting vinegar in the animal's esophagus or stomach. So although the studies have not been done, the science does not support a benefit to heartburn of using vinegar. How about lowering blood sugars? This is all the rage right now, and that's because finally we have some evidence of a benefit. It seems that if you consume 1 to 2 tablespoons of vinegar with a high carbohydrate meal, then you will lower the blood sugar kick that occurs after the meal, though it makes no impact on the A1C, which is actually the measure of long-term blood sugar control. One of the reasons for less of a rise in the blood glucose after eating is that vinegar delays stomach emptying. So therefore the food is absorbed more slowly, though eventually it is all absorbed and thus there's no shift in the A1C. Does it work as an antibacterial agent? Well, it does in food, but not for us on our bodies, not topically for cuts or wounds. So it is used as a preservative in food. Antihypertensive? No studies done there yet. So if you enjoy using vinegar, use it for taste rather than for health. For me, I prefer to use the juice of a fresh lemon with its powerful antioxidants. Robert was born with a language learning difficulty that profoundly affected his ability to learn or follow commands. You can imagine that school was a confusing place to be, especially when he reached high school. Here's his mum, Debbie, talking about their home life and what happened next.
In terms of being a parent and my husband and I working with him, it was pretty much 24/7 supporting Robert. He's a very intelligent boy. He couldn't tie his shoelaces, and it wasn't that he didn't want to, it was that he couldn't. He couldn't follow the steps. He couldn't understand how to put all that together. Any changes in his life, any routine changes, were very difficult for him because a routine change brings language to say, this is what you're doing now, whereas he couldn't understand that. So, you know, he would have a meltdown if there were routine changes. So our life was very structured and ordered because that helped him understand to help him operate in his world. But by the time he was in year seven, it was pretty bad. And my husband and I looked down a very black path for him. We thought, we didn't like what we saw ahead. So when he was in year seven, a colleague of mine gave me Norman Doidge's book, The Brain That Changes Itself, and said to me, you should read chapter 2. And that highlights Barbara's work. It just so happened that 2 months after she gave me the book, I was going to Toronto for work. So I thought, I'm gonna go and visit that school. Because I read the chapter and I was crying on the train. I thought, that is Robert's life. And so I went to the school, and I have been very involved in curriculum development in my career. And so I looked at what was happening in the school. I thought, that's not really what we do in schools. But the more I learn about neuroplasticity and its principles, I realized, well, that's exactly what needs to happen in this program. And so I rang my husband and I said, I don't know how we're going to do this, but we need to get Robert to Canada to go to school. Because at that point, there were no schools in Australia offering the program.
And that program could be the only hope for Robert, but would it work? Find out later in the show. Today's guest is Barbara Arrowsmith-Young, the pioneer of the program that Debbie dreamt of for her son Robert. Back in Barbara's day, she had to rise above a contemporary belief about brain structure and function in order to change her own brain. Here she explains.
It's what I call the pre-neuroplastic paradigm. The belief was that the brain you're born with is the brain that you die with. Basically, if you have a problem, the brain can't change, so the best you can do is learn to live with it, learn to compensate, find workarounds, what I call heroic efforts, because it takes incredible energy and effort to try to work around a difficulty.
So what did you discover? If that was the paradigm of your day, what did you discover that sort of challenged that thinking?
Well, in 1977, and I remember it very well, it was August of 77, someone handed me a book called The Man with the Shattered World. And it was a story of a Russian soldier who had a wound during World War II and a brilliant Russian neuropsychologist, Alexander Luria, who was studying the brain and trying to understand the function of the brain. Because at that time, I knew I had serious problems, but I didn't know the source of the problem. Reading this book, I thought, this man is living my life and I'm living his life. All the things that he couldn't do after the wound, I hadn't been able to do since birth. And I knew I didn't, you know, have a wound in my head, but now I knew that the source of my problem was my brain.
And how old were you at that time?
I was 25 at that time. And it was an epiphany, because to solve a problem, you have to understand the nature of the problem. So now I had the nature of the problem, but what do I do about it? Because still the belief was the brain was fixed.
Right.
Yes, and then I came across the work of Mark Rosenzweig coming out of Berkeley in California, and he was looking at this idea of neuroplasticity. He was actually questioning the idea that the brain was fixed. Now he was working with rats, and what he found is if you put rats in a really stimulating, enriched environment, they became better learners. They learned better on mazes. So something had changed, and then when he looked at their brains had changed physiologically. So he concluded stimulation leads to changes in the brain, which leads to better learning. Neuroplasticity. So I've had to believe at that time, even though nobody was looking at human neuroplasticity, if rats had it, we must, as humans, have it as well. So I set out to create my first experiment to see if I could change my brain.
So you were your first guinea pig.
I was my first guinea pig, yes.
So what did you do?
Well, I went back in and thought about Luria's work, and I figured I have to design an activity or a task that works that part of my brain that wasn't working. And one of the tasks that I created was reading clocks, because I had never been able to tell time. I could not read an analog clock.
So you got to 25, but you couldn't tell time.
I couldn't tell time.
Wow.
I could not.
Even just that is a handicap, isn't it?
Oh, a huge handicap. I mean, I relied on other people. Like, I didn't wear a watch because I couldn't interpret time. Because if you think about clock, to interpret it, you have to understand the relationship between the hour hand and the minute hand. It actually really is a conceptual understanding. And I couldn't do that. I couldn't see the relationship between two elements, even cause and effect, like simple things, like why things happened. There was no cause and effect in my world, so there was no connection between an hour hand and a minute hand. And it wasn't that I wanted to get better at telling time in terms of creating this exercise. I wanted to force my brain to process relationships, and this was a relationship. So I started with two hands, then I built it up to three hands, then four hands. We now have an exercise that has 10 hands that are all interrelated. And again, the idea is we're not trying to help people tell time, we're trying to stimulate that part of the brain that processes relationships. And that's what happened. I mean, eventually I can now tell time, but I can sit and listen to a conversation. I can understand it in real time. I mean, before I could not have had this interview with you because I'd be trying to figure out what you were asking me. Now I can understand in real time. And what to me is so profound, I can be part of human discourse. I can actually relate to people, whereas before I couldn't.
Wow. I can't imagine living like that. And and still, you'd graduated from college. People had high expectations of you. What made you think that it wasn't just that part of the brain was absent, that it was actually there and that you could work it and fix this problem?
I really didn't know. I mean, really, I was going into that place of not knowing, but I felt I didn't have a choice. I mean, at that point, I was incredibly depressed, and I saw no future for myself. So I figured, I have to try something. It may not work, but I have to try.
And I like in your book how you say you had, it was going to take time, but you had that time because you were spending it trying to rote learn everything in life.
That's right, and it wasn't working. I mean, it was incredibly inefficient, and you know, I ended up with depression, anxiety, and actually ended up with an immune system disorder. There's now research to suggest individuals with learning difficulties end up having more physical ailments, because if you think of all those stress hormones that wash through your system constantly, and you can never escape the stress because you're carrying your brain everywhere with you, and you're struggling, it has an impact on your immune system. So not only does it affect you in learning, in relationships, but it actually can affect your physical health.
So let's go back. There was this paradigm of the fixed brain. What do we know now that, you know, you obviously it wasn't an absent area of the brain that you had. You worked on this and you developed it. So tell us, what's the new paradigm?
To me, the new paradigm holds so much hope and so much promise. It is now a given that our brain is capable of change. And to me, it holds so much hope for conditions that we thought were intractable, that we couldn't change. I mean, from learning difficulties, from depression, from anxiety. I mean, they're doing research on post-traumatic stress disorder and neuroplasticity, pain and neuroplasticity, all of these conditions, obsessive-compulsive disorder, even eating difficulties. We know that we can actually change our brain in very positive and constructive ways that can support all sorts of healing. And to me, that's so promising. I think this concept of neuroplasticity has the possibility to alleviate human suffering.
Now, in your book, you say that neurons that fire together wire together. Explain that just briefly for us.
Well, it's the concept of the more you use something, I mean, there's the concept of use it or lose it as well, which is very similar, so that the more that you utilize, you know, those neurons to fire together to learn things in a specific pattern, the stronger they're going to become.
And the stronger they become, the less effort required. Now consider this. In Philippians 4, Paul writes, I have learned, in whatever circumstance I am, to be content. How did Paul learn this? Because I really struggle with this problem. It seems he learned it by experience. He started life in very good circumstances, a bright young scholar with a good education, ready to take on the world. Then Jesus confronted him near Damascus and changed the course of his whole life. He wrote a quick summary of what he'd been through, and this is what it read. 5 times I received 39 lashes with a whip, 3 times beaten with a rod, stoned once, shipwrecked 3 times, including spending 24 hours in the churning sea, in danger from rivers, bandits, Jews and Gentiles, in danger in the city, in the country, working hard, deprived of food, sleep, water and clothing. And added to that, he had the continual concern of the churches that he had planted. When our needs are not met, when our rights are trampled on, when we're mistreated, those are all good lessons for gratitude and contentment. Our Heavenly Father knows it all and allows rebuffs to refine us into a reflection of Him. And it's time to get moving because Sean's here.
Hey. Hi, Sean.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. All right. It's that time again. What are we going to do?
Okay, so I get a lot of questions from people who, you know, bump into me and they say, how do I lose weight? I'm like, you know, you got to work for it.
Yep.
Okay, so I'm going to show you a really quick way of throwing some high intensity training into just a normal routine, which is great for the body, during the workout and post-workout. That's the key, to work out to that level where you're burning calories up to 24 hours post-workout.
Right.
Okay, so if you're at the gym, jump on the treadmill, do some jumping jacks if you choose. If you're at the park, you know, get warmed up. But again, getting the body ready. I'm gonna show you 2 ways of doing mountain climbers, okay?
Okay.
One is we're gonna go down to the ground, keep the hands right here, and we're gonna start with the regular traditional mountain climber. All right, core tight, and before you start, this is the neutral position right here. Your hips are not high. Can you show me how the hips will look high? We don't want it right there. Down, right there, and then begin. Go ahead, boom. So you keep going for about 30 seconds. Okay, make sure you are breathing. The heart rate is gonna start to go up. If you hold your breath, it goes up even higher, okay? Now, if you were to get a little, if this is the first time you're doing this, please take your time, okay? You're in a position where you're working your core, you're working your cardiovascular system, but you don't want to, you know, overexert yourself. And now the crossbody, she'll go right into it where you're taking that right knee and going toward, yes, there you go. This is a little bit more challenging, and this is the upgrade to the mountain climber. So give me about 5 more, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. And what I want you to do is, now that your heart rate is up, now we're gonna go into the more strength building exercise, the plank, okay?
Right.
So now we're building core strength, all right? So here, here, hands are relaxed, your spine is neutral, look down to about right here. The spine is neutral, and if I were to push you, your body would be nice and rigid, okay? This is what you want. This is the plank. It is a great way to burn calories. Are you feeling the challenge?
I am.
You feeling the burn?
I'm feeling the burn.
Already?
After all those mountain climbs.
Okay, there you go. So here it is. We're gonna.
That was the 13th take, remember?
That was. So here we go. And then how do you upgrade this? You turn it right to the side. Put your hand right here. And even if, actually go on your leg like this, right? Now what you could do is just go up on one leg, mm-hmm. right? Keep it there, perfect. And keep the core tight. Now put that hand up just a little bit, and there you go. Now you went from a mountain climber where you increased the heart rate, the plank where you built strength, and here is a little bit more of a challenging plank position,
right.
Which again will help build core strength.
Because you gotta keep balance.
You gotta keep balance. Try the other side real quick, see how that goes.
I'm gonna turn my back.
All right, you can do it. Give me 5, 4, 3, great plank, 2, and 1, good job. Again, you want to challenge yourself. You want to be able to, you know, bring up that heart rate. And think about post-workout. You know, how is your body going to adapt? If you're still sweating after you work out, great job. You
right.
know, still burning calories.
And these big muscles,
yes.
you're just going to burn them that much faster.
Yes, total body exercise is a great way to maximize your time, you know, 10, 15 minutes, and you could reap the benefits.
Now, how do we stretch those?
All right, let's go. So while we're here, let's stretch the calf. Feet down, right there. And then what I want you to do is walk your feet to your hands. Come up nice and slow. Open and close. Take a nice deep breath. Finish off your workout. Big circle. And guess what? You are done. Good job.
Fall asleep. There's still more to watch. Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome.
Parents everywhere are trying to make sense of the childhood obesity epidemic. Well, researchers have found two foods that can help. Children who ate the most grains were almost 40% less likely to be overweight, and the children that enjoyed nuts frequently were one-third less likely to be overweight. Healthy foods like whole wheat toast and peanut butter are kid-friendly and could help your child to maintain a healthy weight. Preventing childhood obesity is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time to answer your questions. Patricia asks, what are the objections to homegrown grass-fed beef? Well, Patricia, there are three aspects to this question. There's the environmental aspect, the ethical aspect, and of course the health one. Environmentally, beef use a lot of land, a lot of feed, not just the grass, they're often supplement fed as well, so you've got to grow that feed, and a lot of water. They drink a lot, there's a lot required to keep that pasture growing grass. From an ethical standpoint, they're slaughtered, we can't get around that. They're dying for us to eat. And then from a health perspective, for our own health, saturated fat and animal protein are associated with cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancers, many common chronic diseases. So lots of issues around that. Next question, someone texted, I eat only the whites of the egg. Is this good or bad? Well, the whites of the egg contain protein. They don't have the fat or the cholesterol that you'll find in the yolk. So it is better than eating the whole egg for sure. Though it is still an animal protein, so it's not as good as plant protein. Roger asks, is it healthy to have a cup of coffee in the morning or after napping? Well, there's a lot of recent research showing that there are health gains from drinking coffee. You live longer, you're healthier, but there is a downside of coffee that's not talked about. It increases blood pressure, increases heart rate, and that in itself is a risk. Increases bladder and bowel irritability.
nervous system irritability, headaches, migraines, bladder and kidney cancers. It's addictive, and the list actually is much longer than that. So I think on balance, it's probably better to avoid coffee if you can get off of it. Remember, you can send your questions to us by Facebook, text, phone, or by contacting us on the website. Like us on Facebook to become part of our Go Healthy for Good community. Now let's see what's for dinner. Although usually just thought of as birdseed, millet is not just to feed birds. It's been an important food staple in Asia and Africa for thousands of years, being identified in many archaeological digs. The reason for its widespread use is that it's resistant to drought and it's able to grow in semi-arid, impoverished, less fertile soil. But crop yield is best when the soil is very fertile and there's good irrigation. Millet has many different varieties, the most popular being pearl millet, which is what I have here. Other varieties include teff and sorghum, the variety determining its colour, white, grey, yellow or red. Millets are rich in B vitamins, calcium, iron, potassium, magnesium and zinc. In India, millet's milled into flour and used to make flatbread. Millet porridge is a traditional food in Russia, Germany and China. And in Russia, it's eaten sweet with milk and sugar added after cooking, or savory with meat or vegetable stews. In China, it's eaten with beans, sweet potato or squash. In Germany, it's also eaten sweet, boiled in water with apples and honey, and they're added after cooling. I enjoy it partly boiled, then baked with raisins, honey, milk and lemon rind. Bon appetit! Today's expert guest is Barbara Arrowsmith-Young, founder and director of Arrowsmith Schools. I asked her why she started her own school.
After I saw the results for myself, and it wasn't just this one area, I had multiple learning difficulties. So after I created the first exercise with the clocks and saw the change, I went on to address a problem I had with not being able to register sensation on the left side of my body, which is a kinesthetic disorder and led me to be very accident prone. Created a different exercise, saw change, then created an exercise for my spatial difficulty. I couldn't construct three-dimensional space, read maps. So I addressed three very different cognitive problems with very different exercises. And I thought, I need to take this out into the world to help other people that are struggling like I am. So I thought, I need to set up a school to help these individuals have a different possibility in their life. And to me, what was very exciting was, obviously, some people walked through the door with the same difficulties I had, but people came through the door with very different difficulties. So that would lead me to go back into Luria's work, to read, to try to understand what they were describing, create exercises that were different from the ones that I created for myself, and eventually, over time, develop 19 different programs, you know, from the individual that can't read non-verbally, the person that can't remember faces, the person that can't remember landmarks, the person that can't remember auditory information that they hear, think, problem-solve, reasoning, numeracy. So a whole range of problems, because I really wanted to help these individuals to have a different, you know, possibility in life.
So in your school, you take children with learning disabilities and adults. Define learning disability for us.
I see as a learning disability as a cognitive function, something that isn't working effectively, efficiently, or automatically, that is leading that individual to struggle with learning. So it can be a whole wide range of problems. I mean, for a number of years, people didn't look at a nonverbal learning disability as a learning disability. They'd say, well, that person is socially awkward. They struggle navigating the social world. But we now know that is, I like the word learning difficulty. In Australia, they use the term learning difficulty, not disability. Mm-hmm. So that is a learning difficulty. I think anything that prevents an individual from fully engaging in the world can be looked at as a learning difficulty, and you remove that difficulty, you give them a strength where there was previously a problem, and the whole world opens up. I mean, I work with a lot of adults as well, and what they say to me is they feel that their career was chosen for them. They got to a certain point and they said so many doors were closed that I only had this one or two to walk through. And I think what this work does is it opens multiple doors, and then those individuals have a choice in terms of what they want to do with their life.
So when we think of learning difficulty, we think of children, but you're saying this is more about
functional difficulty, isn't it? It's very broad.
It is.
In your book, you talk about effortful processing. Mm-hmm. Explain that term so that mm-hmm. our viewers, I loved reading your book, but explain it so our viewers can understand mm-hmm. that. Because I think that's the core of what your curriculum involves.
It is really, really critical. So there are kind of a couple of elements. One is you have to find a task or activity that's going to work that cognitive function. And then the next is effortful processing. So if you make the task too simple, it's like the brain isn't going to engage. It's almost like it's just not engaged, right? It's not a workout. And if you make it too difficult, it's almost like the brain is spinning gears. It can't engage. So if the level of current functioning is sort of holding it at a certain point, you have to make the level of the difficulty of the activity just slightly above where that function is currently holding. And then it engages in effortful processing. So it, through doing the work, it's getting the stimulation, and then it steps up to that level, and then you make it a little bit more difficult. And one of the challenges in a lot of programs for individuals with learning difficulties is they either make it way too difficult, so the individual isn't engaged, or they make it way too easy, and the individual is also not engaged. So you have to find that perfect kind of calibration, almost like physical exercise. I mean, if you go to the gym and try to lift 75 pounds and you haven't been working out, you're not going to be able to lift that. If they start at 20 pounds and you can engage, you can start to progress up to eventually being able to lift the 75 pounds.
Mm. Now, tell us, you have what you called symbol relations mm-hmm. deficit, where you strengthen that with the clock face. But you say the most common people that come into your schools is a motor symbol sequencing deficit. Mm-hmm. Just explain that for us, and mm-hmm. then explain how you work around that mm-hmm. or how you train that part of the brain.
Okay. I think whether it's more common, but it's certainly easy to identify. This is the individual, think of a child, that you have a conversation with them and they can tell you a beautiful story. And it can go on 5, 10, 15 minutes, really elaborate. You put a pen or a pencil in that child's hand and ask them to tell you the same story on paper, and maybe in 5 minutes, one or two sentences go down on the page. So it's really the ability to translate thought into the motor plan, the written plan. And there's a problem cognitively with that translation. So it's not about thought or ideation. I mean, they've got lots of thought and they can be very elaborate in their thinking, but they can't externalize it on paper. This is the individual that on a timed exam, you take the time limits off because, again, they can't produce in written form details or quickly. So it is a real barrier. And I had one student that talked about, he said he felt trapped inside his head. He had all these ideas, but he couldn't get them down on paper for exams. So it definitely has an impact. And especially we know, even though now a lot of things are done computerized, I mean, you still have to fill out forms, job applications. So this is the individual that would struggle with that aspect of learning. So we have a program that really trains the individual to learn motor plans. So again, they're learning multiple, from really simple motor plans to really complex motor plans, until they became really automatic. And once it becomes automatic, we then make it more difficult, again, that concept of effortful processing. And it's really not that we want them to learn motor plans, but we want to train the brain and strengthen that part of the brain that learns motor plans. So eventually, and we see that. We see the child that you now give them the same 5 minutes, they can write 2, 3, 4 pages, whereas before they were writing 2, 3 sentences.
Wow. Incredible. Stand by for more from Barbara and Debbie after the break. Robert had learning difficulties so bad that as an intelligent teen, he was unable to follow instructions, even things as simple as tying his own shoelaces. His mother gave up work as a school principal and took Robert from Australia to the Arrowsmith School in Canada. Let's see if the sacrifice paid off.
It was 7 weeks into the program when I noticed the first change for him. We were sitting in our very tiny little apartment, and I asked him to put the kettle on so I was going to make a cup of tea. And I was working on my laptop, and the next minute I got a cup of tea put down on my desk. And I said nothing, because all I could do was look at that cup of tea, because He would never have done that. Because previously I would have said, can you put the kettle on? Can you get the mug out? Can you get the tea bag out? Now, when the kettle boils, can you put the water in? Can you get the milk, put the milk in the tea, and then can you bring it over to me? That's what I would have had to have done. He would not have been able to get the sequence of steps. He wouldn't have been able to understand all of those steps if I had have said them in one go. And then all of a sudden, I get this cup of tea. I had tears running down my eyes. I'd said nothing to him because I didn't want to make it too huge a deal of it. It was 10 weeks into the program where Robert noticed a change. He was 16, because every holidays he has some sort of movie marathon. He started off with Star Wars Episode 1, and about half an hour into the movie, he stopped the movie, he turned around, his eyes were huge, and he said, "Mum, I think this program is working." And I said, "Why, mate?" He goes, "Mum, I'm hearing words in this movie I have never heard before. Mum, I'm understanding what they're saying for the first time." He said, "Before, when I didn't understand what they would say, I would say the words over and over again in my head like a beat. And I said them over until I could try and make sense of them." He said, "I don't have to have the beat anymore." So I was thrilled. And so we knew we had made the right decision. We went back to Australia for the summer, for the North American summer. And he got off the plane and all our friends and family said, "You've brought home a different boy." He was confident. He was chatty. He was participating in conversations which he couldn't before. He was a very social boy, and he was fine if he started the conversation, but if he could not join in the conversation. And so he was joining in conversations. People were astounded. But that was just the start. And so then he went back for the other 6 months until the following January. By that point, the Sydney Catholic Schools had started the program. That's where I had been working. And Sydney Catholic Schools had started the program. And he continued his journey in Sydney for 18 months. And then when we moved to Toronto, he did his last year in Arrowsmith in the adult program there.
Robert got his high school diploma in 1 year and has gone on to college. He now has choices, a future, and hope, thanks to the Arrowsmith program. And this book by today's guest, Barbara Arrowsmith-Young, is full of stories similar to Robert's. Here, Barbara explains what a typical day is like in an Arrowsmith program.
So if they are coming to the school in Toronto or a school in Peterborough or the schools in Vancouver, they would be doing eight 40-minute periods a day. And out of those eight periods, they would be doing six cognitive periods. So what that means is those six periods, they would be working on exercises to strengthen their areas of difficulty, and then you would have one period of math and one period of English language arts. Because what we find is, what do we learn with? We learn with our brain. So if our brain is strengthened and they're grounded in mathematics and they're grounded in, you know, basic principles of language arts or English, they can pick up all of the other subject matter. Whereas before, if they had the difficulties, they could sit in class, you know, year after year, and maybe learning half a year per year, two-thirds of a year per year. What we find after this program is they're accelerating, at times learning double or triple what they were learning before. Now, we put this program into existing schools. That's really my vision. It's not opening more schools, but finding schools that are interested in implementing the program. And there, what we request is four 40-minute cognitive periods per day, so the child would be spending half of the day coming in and out of a cognitive classroom with a trained teacher, doing the exercises, and the other four periods they would be integrated into, you know, their other curriculum. So it's a nice blend of getting, you know, the cognitive program and getting the academic program.
And so for the students that are in the Toronto program, they would then go to school when they finish there and play catch up for a year, 2 years, to an accelerated learning to catch up with their peers.
That's correct. And some go in with needing no catch up. I mean, their cognitive functioning is in place. They can pick up the, you know, basically where they left off, and now they can reason. Wow. They can remember. They can problem solve. They can create strategies like that. That cognitive ability is there. So some will say, maybe in the first year out, you know, recommend that the parents get a tutor just to help them support that learning. So some do, some don't. It really, really depends. And one thing that I'm really excited at is we're also looking at this idea of cognitive enhancement, where anybody can benefit from good cognitive stimulation. I mean, we all know that there's probably an area that we don't function in as well as another area. And so anybody can benefit from this program. There's a university in Spain that's looking at taking on the program, putting all of their university students into the with the reasoning exercise, because everybody can benefit from enhanced reasoning. We have a couple of schools that their whole grade one class, so the students starting in grade one are doing one cognitive exercise. So that motor symbol sequencing that we talked about, because in grade one of the things you're doing is learning how to read, learning how to write. And we did this in a school in Australia, and what to me was fascinating was in kindergarten, 5 of the 20 students had been identified as needing reading recovery. 10 weeks into the program, not one of them needed reading recovery, because really early on, we were stimulating that cognitive function related to eye tracking, motor functioning, motor planning and reading, also in writing, and they didn't need reading recovery.
Now, it sounds to me like there's been some research, at least data collection, going on around these individuals who've gone through your school.
It's very exciting. We're doing research at the University of British Columbia in British Columbia, in Vancouver. And we're also doing research at the University of Southern Illinois in Carbondale, in Illinois. And we're doing imaging research as well as tracking these students academically and on cognitive measures. And what to me is so exciting is we're actually seeing the brain change. I mean, we've had a lot of research in the past looking at outcomes, like looking at academic outcomes, looking at learning outcomes, rate of learning improving. This is the first chance we've had to actually do imaging on these students. We're seeing the prefrontal cortex, which is critical for attention, for problem solving, strategizing, changing in both research studies. We're seeing the brain process more efficiently over time. So we know a lot of these students are calling on a lot of real estate in the brain to solve problems. And it's actually better if you're calling on less real estate because it's much more efficient. And we're seeing that happen. So, and I know the research at the University of British Columbia has been submitted for publication. So hopefully in the next couple of months, we will see some articles. So it's really exciting. It feels like my life's work is coming to fruition.
Yes. Real fruition. Though I obviously in your book, you've got so many lives that have been changed. But how many schools do you have now, Erasmus schools, around the world?
There are over 90 schools that offer the program. And again, these are independent schools. They're not affiliated or owned in any way by me. I have two schools myself, one in Toronto and one in Peterborough, and I see them as my laboratory schools. This is where, you know, we refine things, we develop new programs, and then we train teachers around the world and put these out. So we're in schools in Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia, Thailand, and South Korea.
Fabulous. And those teachers actually come into your two schools to get their training?
They come to, we do Toronto training in July, and we now do training in Australia in January, February. So we have the training in Southern Hemisphere and Northern Hemisphere.
And how long does training take for a teacher?
It's a 3-week course.
3 weeks.
Yes.
Wow, this is something that is, I can just see rolling out and really changing mm-hmm. lives around the world. So, tell me, how do adults, can adults go through your schools or through the Erasmus program? I know that you mentioned Spain is going to do it with their adult students, but what about the rest of us?
Absolutely. A number of the schools or educational organizations offer adult programs, and so if people are interested, on our website it lists all the places where people can go for adult programs. I mean, I've worked with people up into their 80s. I mean, to me, what's so promising, this idea of neuroplasticity, it's across our lifespan. So I'm happy as I'm getting older to know that my brain is hopefully still plastic. I know it's still plastic. So
and
so
the
people
gains,
can come in.
Okay, and the gains that children get will last their lifetime.
Yes, we've tracked students, you know, 30, 35 years out of the program, and there's no drop-off in function. In a sense, it's a little different than a muscle, even though we use that analogy. But I think what happens is once the function is in place, it starts to get its own stimulation. You don't have to keep doing the cognitive exercise. because it's being used every day. You're starting to use that cognitive function in your daily activities.
And that's the incredible power of overcoming learning difficulties. Cognitive exercises done to make everyday tasks easier and automatic, and to become more flexible and adaptive, thereby achieving your greatest potential. For more information about Arrowsmith Schools or to find one near you, go to arrowsmithschool.org. That's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.